three-dimensional transforming musical linguistic object.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. I'm Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, we podcast a talk given by Christian Rosch at the ruins down in Palenque, Mexico, and the response was so positive that I thought, well, we'll just add another one of Christian's talks here to the Psychedelic Salon. And the one you're going to hear today was recorded on a Monday afternoon in January of 2001. And like many of these talks, the sound quality isn't as perfect as what we'd like, but in its own strange way, it gives a good impression of what the Entheo Botany conferences down in Mexico were like. This talk, as I said, was given by Christian, and it was given at the end of the pool, outdoors, at the Chanca Hotel, just down the road from the ruins. And you can hear how casual these talks were. A number of people interrupt from time to time, and there's actually several interchanges with Jonathan Ott during part of this talk that Christian gave. And if you go to our website and click on Christian's name, it'll take you to a page where there's down at the bottom of the page, there's a couple pictures of Christian sitting at the end of the pool, maybe giving this talk. I'm not sure if those were taken at this talk or another one. So why don't you sit back and relax and enjoy Christian Rosch talking about witches' ointments and aphrodisiacs, myths, plants, and recipes.
Is it okay if I sit down? Because I love that position. And if I speak this way, it flies away.
And there are no fish.
Oh yeah, there are. Well, this is Mexico. All right. It's very good that Ken put us together, because we belong to each other. And I want to show you, we put out a book called Witches' Medicine. The rediscovery of an illegal art of healing, shamanic traditions in Europe. And I have a very big section on classical antiquity, especially on Hecate Kirke, what is her real name, not Circe, and Medea. And people usually wonder why you go back to classical antiquity. I will tell you in a second. My talk is, I believe, it's called Witches, Ointments, and Aphrodisiacs. And that's the plan and the scheme. And we have all kinds of fantasies about witches' ointments. Has anybody of you ever taken a witch's ointment? Okay. What?
What they call flying ointment. Yeah.
Did you get off?
Well, I made it, so yeah, I can assure you I got off hardcore. I made it with a lot of Datura.
Okay. So, then you're the only two persons. Claudia did also.
Yeah.
And the first I have to say is there is nothing what we can actually call a witch's ointment. Witch's ointment is a fantasy. It's a literary tradition from the first book in European history, and that's the Odyssey from Homer. Well, the witches' ointments are also called flying ointments. In German we have also this wonderful word, Buhlsalbe. Yeah, you know that, but is anybody able to speak German or to understand?
Say it again.
Buhlsalbe.
Buhlsalbe, some salve of what?
Yeah, Zalbe means ointment.
It's the same word used.
Yeah. But Buhl means to fuck. Buhlen is if you especially do illegal fucking. I think that's also called adultery or so.
Adultery.
Yeah, adultery.
Prostitution. Or there's some other things that are illegal in our country.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't talk about North America or the U.S. No, to be specific. Nowadays, especially in feminist-oriented groups, they do this rediscovery of witchcraft, and they put out their fantasies on what may have been or happened in the past. And there is a modern witchcraft tradition. I hope I don't offend anyone of you who's in that kind of stuff. They call it New Paganism or Wicca cult or witchcraft. And it's mostly Californian writers, mostly female, because people think witches are only female. That's another illusion and projection. So, and in these circles, they sit in the night and they do drumming and chanting and so. And in all the books, there is a little reference to witches' ointments. Mostly they say they used also hallucinatory drugs or so. And always there's a warning, they are too dangerous. So don't use them. You can do it with drumming. Or this very famous saying, you can do it without it. Or I can do it without it. And then you ask, yeah, what do you mean by that? I achieve the same state of mind or altered state without it. And it is the drug, the psychoactive substance. And then you ask, oh, did you ever try one? Oh no, because I know I can do it without it. How can you know that you can do something with a different technology, alternative to the real thing? It's like homeopathic medicine. You can do it without it. Because there's nothing in it. It's just water. Maybe a few drops of alcohol, and that's maybe the active principle of homeopathic medicine. That's what I think. I'm a little provocative, just to make you think. And so the core, the centerpiece of shamanism, which is what we may call witchcraft, the dark side of shamanism also, is taking pharmacologically highly active substances. And that is overlooked by so-called scholars like Iliade, who thought shamans taking stuff are degenerated. That's not the real trance. But how can he know? He never did anything. He was one of these foreigners of the modern Californian subculture. And you see, there is a big thing against psychoactives from people who never did them. If you get a court case, ask the judge, have you ever taken this stuff I should go to jail for? Of course not. He claims, and then he goes into the toilet to snort up some coke. And, just give you a little joke, but it's true. In the parliament hall of the German government, there were some journalists, and they took some samples from the toilet, you know, those things you flush the water, and they came with some little papers or so and cleaned it off and did analysis of it. And all the toilets in the governmental parliament house were full of cocaine. So they don't allow people to take it, but they do it by themselves. Yeah?
I just wanted to interject. Here in Mexico, it came out in the paper about 2 months ago that they're going to apply piss tests to all the state legislators from one of the northern states because they were seen snorting coke in the bathroom. And they always came to so-called work drunk and so forth.
Yeah, and coming from cocaine and government, going back to the witch's ointment, and there is something similar, because what we know is the recipes that was used by the high class people, like cocaine today, but they didn't allow it to the low class people, and they said that's a witch's ointment, and this is illegal, and if you use it, you go to jail, or you get burned, or get torn into pieces by horses, or whatever. So it's always the high-class people and the governmental people who take the stuff they don't allow the general public to take. And that was, it's like they keep the monopoly for the stuff, but they don't want to share it. They don't want to sit in circles and get mystical enlightenment or so. And that was the case with the witch's ointment from almost the very beginning. So, I said it's a literary tradition, the concept of the witch's ointment. And that started with the Odyssey from Homer. There was a self called the flying self, and that was used by Hera. We usually think Hera is this puritanic, shitty woman who beats up her husband Zeus, and she's known as the mother goddess. But in the Odyssey, they mentioned exactly that she used an ointment on her body so she could fly. So, the flight was described as from one point to the other in almost no time. It sounds to me like if somebody tried poetically, of course, to describe, beam me up, Scotty. And then the next mention, or the next literary document of ointments to do magic and to fly in a second over the all over the earth is kind of maybe magic. And that was in the stories about Jason and the Argonauts going to Colchis. I don't know how you pronounce Colchis in English. Well, Colchis is the Greek pronunciation.
Colossus.
No?
Colossi, was it? Or Colossus.
No.
Colchis. No, that is now. I can't keep on with the names of these places. It's
Colchis. Colchis.
Yeah. Oh, Colchis is it?
This is a place you're talking about.
It's a place. Yeah, an area or a country. Okay. It was. Nowadays, it's some part of the ex-USSR. It's at the east side of the Black Sea. And so the story that was given by the Hellenistic writers. They were all male, of course. There was never a female. Only one we know of. It's Sappho, the lesbian woman from the island of Lesbos. That's where the name comes from. And so it was all male writers or poets. And they gave some different stories of the mythology or of the imagination or of the common belief in the Hellenistic place around Greece, Athens. So in Colchis there were Oriental people, and they looked on them like they called them like niggers or so, some equivalent to it. They were dark and so. And there, it was said, is the garden of Hecate. I don't know how you pronounce it in English, but...
Hecate.
Yeah, well, the stress is on in the beginning. So Hecate's garden was described as a kind of fort. And so... And on top of the entrance was a statue of her. And the, how you say, Hellenic people or Hellenistic? Or
Hellenic.
Hellenistic people. They thought, oh, this is Artemis. And that's very interesting. Please keep that in mind, that they thought that Hecate is the same as Artemis. And so, in the literature, they described the garden pretty nice. And it was like Jonathan's garden, Rancho Ololiqui. It was full of psychoactive plants and deadly poisonous plants. And they all named. And fortunately, we have a good tradition of Greek into medieval literature and into modern literature about the identification of plants. And most plant names were coined, the botanical plant names were coined by Linnaeus. How you say Linne, maybe, huh?
Linnaeus.
That's the Latin form. In reality, his name was Linné. And he was trained in classical mythology. And so, all the psychoactive plants he named after some mythological words or names from classical antiquity. So, actually, what we today will call the witch's garden, all these psychoactive and poisonous plants, got their names from the Greek gods and goddesses and so on and so on. And he used also the Greek names. And so that was kind of, he kind of preserved some of that, and he put like the whole Greek mythology into names for plant species and for also for shell species and for all kinds of animals and so. It's very, very interesting to look at the names of plants, and that is also something I have to point out. You never know to which plant species the name is applied. Especially the older the source, it's getting more and more difficult to identify the plant, because there is no real tradition. But the names survive, and many times the names of a plant, I mean, like the common names or the non-official names, are used for totally different genera. And so you never know what people in their writings talk about. And for example, when in early writings, when somebody says, "Oh yeah, they ate a mushroom," yeah, we are tempted to think, "Oh yeah, it must have been a psychedelic mushroom." But mushroom is a general term, and so nobody knows what it is. It's you can project into it, and so on. It's like with the term soma. I came to the conclusion that the term soma is exactly like the term entheogen. It doesn't goes to a specific plant. It goes to plants used in rituals to get high or to get inside and so on. And that is the same with that word, witch's ointment. There is no recipe. And that sounds strange, because if you buy cheap and cheesy books on witchcraft, they always they say, "Oh yeah, there's the witch's ointment, but I can't tell you the real recipe because it's too dangerous." It's like if you go to a botanical garden, to the section of medicinal healing plants, there's always warnings: don't touch the plant, it's totally poisonous. And isn't that strange? Did you ever see that? And I observed in many botanical gardens that exactly the plants who are allegedly the part of the recipe of the so-called witch's ointment, they all have these warnings. The only exception I saw recently in Bern, the capital of Switzerland, they have a very beautiful botanical garden, and the director is hair. So there at the cannabis plants, there is a warning: don't even take it. This is non or low containing THC levels, something like that. Don't just destroy the plant because you won't get off, something like that. I think that's a nice warning. Instead of saying, "Oh, thorn apple, deadly poisonous, don't even touch." That's total bullshit. They maybe do it for so you can't be can't sue them or whatever. I don't know. So going back from this little footnote and a footnote and a footnote, I learned this, by the way, from Jonathan. Well, he doesn't listen. It doesn't matter. Homer, of course, did not put a recipe for Hera's flying ointment. It was just said it's a flying ointment. And, well, I went back to the Greek original to find out what they use, what words they use for things translated as like a poison or a medicine and so on. And there's one thing that is very clear, that it belongs to what the category of pharmakon. Have you heard that word? That's the root of pharmacology. And during the centuries, when people translated Greek into whatever language, the translator chose if he want to say poison or medicine. And that's totally biased, of course. And the translations of the Greek originals are heavily altered by how you translate this stuff. And the true meaning of pharmakon is a substance that really works in different ways. It can be a medicine, or it can be a poison to your system, but that depends on the dose, the dosage. You may be familiar with the Paracelsus citation. Jonathan, do you know how to say Paracelsus quote in English? The dose-related stuff?
Everything is a poison, and there's nothing without poison, only the dose determines the poison.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that was perfect. Oh. Everybody attributes that to Paracelsus. He was just—he just knew what the Greeks already had in their minds, and so all the classical witches in Greek and Roman literature were said they used the pharmakon, and they knew if they can heal or kill with it. It's like a knife. With a knife you can do your kitchen work or you can kill somebody. So one thing is to live and one thing is to die. And that applies to everything. It's the human use of something which may be coined as good or bad, or whatever. And the definition of entheogen is absolutely right. That it is a cultural way to use a plant, and you don't want to overdose you, but not underdose you. It depends on your knowledge of using this plant in what way ever. And so that was the same thing with all these ointments. So usually the story of Medea and Hecate and Hecate's garden has been translated in a demonizing way. You see, most translations of old literature are based on opinions and on purposes, and you can find, for example, Platon, if you go through the centuries and look at the translations, his most important work, I guess, is the Symposion. So, normally, at least in German translations, they called it Gastmahl. What is a Gastmahl?
Gastmahl?
Yeah?
Meal.
Yeah, it's a meal for guests. But symposium means a round of people getting fucked up with wine. With some additives, of course. And, so now days the new translations call it Trinkgelage. Trinkgelage. Gelage is it's like a drinking party. Yeah, because they laid down like this and got served by small boys, and well, afterwards they used these boys, and then they came out when they were totally drunk, and they came out with these philosophical ideas that became the roots of Western civilization.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, and they. I found out a lot of additives to wine they used, and all these additives were in Hecate's garden, and later became the so-called witches' plants. So there is a long, long list. Maybe if somebody is interested in the botanical stuff, you can look in this book, because botanical names are everywhere the same. Only the pronunciation is different. They are all the nightshade plants, we know. Have you ever thought about the name Nightshade? Does anybody of you know what Nightshade really means? Okay. It's it comes from Germanic Schaden der Nacht. Schaden der Nacht means how would you translate Schaden?
Harm.
It's actually harm. And Albtraum?
Nightmare.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And nightmare is the real translation, and not nightshade.
Somebody got it wrong or got confused with.
Yeah, that's very probable. That's another source of confusion. When they rewrote books or so, and or copied, they did not look at the.
Anglicized the word, but doesn't just refer to another word.
Right.
Mean,
yeah, yeah. So it's a nightmare, and that's because these plants can cause bad nightmare like trips. Did anybody of you had a trip on nightshades?
How do you do it? Do you use a berry or do you use a vine?
No, this is later.
Okay.
First, the linguistics and the history, and then the botanical hardcore science. And the rest is up to you.
Have you?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I have a question about this. I read an article and they seem to call the entities that they saw shades. Does that have anything to do with it?
I don't know. So, the prominent nightshade plants in the early herbals in Germany, and that was in the time Claudia talked about, mostly, in the 16th century, the nightshade were all put together. They were actually good botanists already. And in German literature, the authors of these herbals are called the fathers of botany. Because from that, Linnaeus took a lot of information. So these nightshade plants were represented botanically very correct. And in some of these books, you find just a little sentence saying, oh, the mandrake is associated with devil's worship and or is used by witches, but not in all. So from the botanical literature of that time, you cannot get any recipe for a witch's ointment. There is little hints in. But because it's written in an older Germanic language, basically nobody of the scholars read it because they don't understand it. And unfortunately, no American read it. You're not an American anymore. And not American. And it's a lot of information is totally overlooked from that period where the alleged witch's ointments came from. All the recipes which survived in reports or in Catholic writings or so, they all written up by male physicians. And not why they asked somebody for the ingredients. Because they thought, if I want to have a flying experience, what should I do? What kind of drug should I take to fly away to the witch's sabbath? Or to the orgy of the fairies or whatever. And so they created recipes And I'm sure they did bioassay them. And I'm sure there is some stuff that works. So, the plants from Hecate's garden that was described when Jason looked for the golden fleece are exactly the same you find in these recipes written down in the 16th century. What people now believe, that's the witch's ointment. So maybe these doctors were freaks. We even have doctors in our group. So it's not so amazing that doctors know what to do to get high. So... Oh yeah, somebody told me most opium and morphine recipes are for the doctors themselves. That's typical. The prescriptions, yeah. Oh yeah, thank you. So they put many things together. The most prominent was henbane. Chrysanthemis, as a solanation plant, and deadly nightshade, mandrake, thorn apple, bitter Zeus, Solanum dulcemara. Is there an English name for it?
It's a
no. It's a nightshade. Yeah, the sweet nightshade. And then they always mentioned all forms of papaver somnifera, the plant that produces opium. They mentioned opium and poppy seeds and even leaves and the whole plant. And then they also mentioned cannabis. And then they mentioned sometimes what is called rus. And in older times people thought, scholars thought that is the...
Rhubarb.
Rus? Yeah, no. If you have a flame and something gets black.
Oh,
sure. Huh? Suck? Okay. No, but in reality, that's ergot. And,
Smut.
Yeah, corn smut, yeah. And then they have some plant names we are not able to identify at all. And, then there is some herbs without psychoactive properties. And so the recipe for the so-called flying ointment was almost the same as the recipe for a salve that has been used like aspirin in the whole medieval time and also in later time. This unguentum populeum, that's the Latin name and the pharmacist's name for it, and that has basically the same structure of the recipe, and they used that as a very common remedy. And you could get it in the pharmacies everywhere, like and in stores and so, like you get aspirin today. And it was very popular. It was called unguentum populeum because it had, populus? Poplar, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. You last year, Julia brought, no, 2 years ago, you brought some of these, how do you call them?
Balm.
The pots or?
Balm, it's the buds.
The buds,
the overwinter buds.
Yeah. And they only grow in America. Often it's called balm of Gilead. And that came to Europe only in the 16th century. And they used the resin of that to stable the salt and mix in belladonna and henbane and mandrake and all kinds of psychoactive stuff. And it's in the sources we have where they talk about witches' ointments, that's very few actually, they always said it's a green paste like salt. And so they also said that, well, both. The unguentum populium is green and the witch's ointment is green. So, if they want to get rid of somebody in the city, they just go to their house and say, oh, there's the green salt, so you're a witch. It's like if you get some marijuana bugs, you're a witch. And these days, that was always a system of accusation. And so this recipe survived until today, but in each century they took out some of the psychoactive stuff. And today you can even buy it in a German pharmacy, but it's only some kind of salt and populus.
Again?
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention, in English there's a word for this also, which is whale, W-A-L-E, and this is mentioned in Chaucer in the 1300s and goes back probably 1,000 years, but it's an ointment for sleeping, for a somniferous, but that word is in English, it's also an anger word, and it has the same nightshade gland, but it was not for any other purpose than the sedative.
Yeah, and so to combine different things is a very old tradition. That's why in Greece they combined, not as bad as in Egypt. And then there is this other tradition in pharmaceutical history. Have you ever heard of theriac? Yeah, you, of course, but nobody else?
Theriac?
Yeah, theriac?
Theriac.
Theriac is either a potion or a salt. That was developed in ancient Greece, and that also contains most of the plants associated with the witch's ointment. And this theriac was developed as an antidote for poisoning for the king, because he was totally scared by poison murder, and so his personal physician developed that recipe, and that contains almost all the witch's plants, and the so-called witch's plants, because we don't know anything, actually. Only the history of tradition and rewriting and so on, and that's it. And so that theriac was based on opium, large amounts of opium. That's always considered to be an antidote. For example, for cannabis poisoning. and they combined the opium with all kinds of pharmaca. That's plural of pharmacon. And added squeezed out snakes. And it obviously there's evidence that if you ingest poisonous snakes, you get high, and so on. But I don't want to get into snakes. Well, sometimes they mentioned as a part of the witch's brew, but I don't talk about the witch's brew. That would be another talk, totally different. That you take on a daily basis, it was like this immune-stimulating fantasy that is put on all kinds of stuff. And also that, so there were dealers of theriac in medieval times. We know only sources of the use of it in Central Europe from 14th century on, basically. And the recipe of theriac also survived. You can buy it in a German pharmacy. But then it's called theriacum sin opio. So they took out the main ingredient. Theriac sin opio means theriac without opium. So it's like the Coca-Cola thing, to go back to the Coca thing. And they take out what the people wanted it for. So the theriac had been used as a recreational drug more than as a medicine. And the theriac dealers became very rich. And then the people got happier and healthier, and then the theriac sales were outlawed, of course. That never happens to the unguentum populeum, but it was like that. So, I did a lot of experiments with the combination of the so-called witches' plants, like nightshades and opium, cannabis, and even olibanum, the church, the Catholic Church incense, became part of the family of ingredients. And so I found out that if I combine them in a, like a smoking mixture, it gives me a very nice high. In my book, Plants of Love, you can find the recipe, the Hexenhammer. How is that being translated? The Hexenhammer.
Hammer.
The Witch's Hammer. Yeah, that was the book they used to define what a witch is. There is the mention in it, that was the main book the Inquisitors used, there is a mention of an ointment, but no ingredients, nothing. And from the protocols of law cases against the so-called witches, there is almost never a mention of a plant. There's only one case, real mention of henbane in these protocols. No, that's why they killed her, probably. Real mention of henbane in these protocols. No, that's why they killed her, probably. I don't know. That's not sad. It's just the evidence that she used an illegal drug. And in some folk literature and so on, henbane was always connected to divination and also to witchcraft. And if you look at the names of henbane, then you find many references that it's a devilish plant, it's a demonized plant, and that the older, the more you go back in history, then you only get names for henbane like Apollinaris. That's a modern brand of mineral water in Germany. That Apollinaris means the plant of Apollon. And Apollon is the god of divination. He is the one who puts, who takes the body of the Pythia and to speak through her mouth. And what we know is that she went into trance by inhaling what I call ferocious fumes. You can hear about that later. But she did deep inhaling of it, and then she fell in trance, and she was uttering or stumbling on words, and nobody could understand. And that's perfect, because the priests were the translators, and so they could write down whatever they want to the clients. And the priests were actually controlling the whole antique world.
Jones?
Yeah.
And in Castellano, in Spanish, the word for henbane is beleño.
Yeah.
Which is an imported word. It's supposed to be a Celtic eating called belenos. But and then there's a Spanish word that's in common use, embelesar, which is derived from that. It means to make someone ecstatic.
Yeah.
Nothing, no devils about that.
Yeah, yeah. Some words survive. And our German name, Bilsenkraut, is kraut means herb, and Bilsen is it comes from Bilse. That's a fairy. So that's also still a nice name. But in Brittany, they call it devil's eye. And because that herb is very potent. Never do a henbane without somebody who can tie you on a tree. And that plant and all the other nightshades can produce complete delirium and produce a blackout kind of thing. Henbane was an official drug in Germany until the 1970s, and then they took it off the pharmacopoeia because some of the youngsters, the young hippies and so on, they heard that, if you take it, you get high. Well, and then they bought cigarettes to smoke against asthmatic attacks. And they took one cigarette, they did not smoke it, but made a tea out of it and drank it. And then 3 days later you can find them totally naked somewhere in the woods. And they don't know anything, or they don't remember anything from the trip. And they even don't know or remember how they got drinks or so. Because if you take henbane, you get a very, very dry mouth. And everything dries up. And you get reddish skin. And you get so thirsty. You can drink as much as you want. It's never enough. And that's also the same case with Datura, with Brugmansia, with Mandrake, with Deadly Nightshade, and so on. The effects are not so different. The safest of these plants is Mandrake, in my experience. And the henbane was used as an incense, not only in ancient Greece, but also by the Germanic prophetesses. We call them Alrunas, that means the one who knows everything.
Frog.
And what?
Frog.
Prophetess. Yeah, and so the fumes of that can get, especially in women, produce a trance-like state. But you have really to know how much you inhale, and that differs from person to person totally. I cannot give you any amount what will work to the Albert Hofmann way, if you want to get to it. And so It's a typical European obsession to put make a duality. So in the Catholic churches, they use the good incense, and among the pagans, they use the bad incense. But the pagans use the incense to get connected to the gods and goddesses. And because they also turned into devils and witches, incense became devilish. So there is one source in Germanic history that points out that three young girls go naked and do the henbane to produce rain. And of course the Catholics changed that into, oh, the witches call the hailstorm for a bad neighbor or so. But that's a universal belief. If you did this ceremony to draw the rain, they were accused to be witches, to do harm. And in recent books on botany, you can look through, and every plant is just described in a very neutral manner. But if you go to henbane, they say, oh, the plant already stinks like the devil. You can find this in modern books. I mean, in books they sell to the public who wants an identification guide and so on. And you only get it with these plants. Have you heard of Hildegard von Bingen?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Great mystic writer, right?
What?
Mystic writer.
Yes, incredible. Well. Well, she was a nun.
Anchoress. Uh-huh.
What?
Abbess?
Anchoress.
Abbess?
She had herself put in, she was in a cell. How do you say that?
Well, she was in a monastery, and she had these strange visions, and she... allegedly, I mean, we don't...
Convent, Christian.
A convent? Okay. She was one of the few persons in the late medieval age who could write and read. And she studied several languages, and she collected all kinds of information from classical writings about plants and pharmacy. And she also collected all kinds of information from the peasants. And at that time, that was still the pagan stuff was still alive, especially in the backyard people. And so she compiled a book that's called Physica, and that's about plants used for medicine. And that's very interesting source, because you can easily track down mm-hmm. The source she used for a plant which was not native in Germany. And it was very descriptive, the whole book. But if you go to plants like belladonna, the deadly nightshade, she says, oh, this is a plant of the devil. And she doesn't do it with any other plants, only with belladonna and henbane. And that shows that there is a long tradition and history of blaming the plants to be devilish. And especially henbane. That is the best documentation of that. And I just read a new novel about revived Dionysian Bacchanalian cult in southern France. Mm. And of course, it was all blamed on henbane. And I can understand when people do a bioassay with henbane and they do a dose that is too high. In Germany in the 70s, they started to call the high of henbane the Hieronymus Bosch trip. And that's also a very interesting connection, because maybe Bosch took nightshade plants, and people who took nightshade plants can see it in his paintings. I mean, if you look at some kind of art, you see, oh, this is LSD, this is DMT, this is pop, this is ketamine, and so on. And, well, that's just an interpretation. Because of your own experience, you relate this together. You never know if the artist did it, but it reminds you to your own experience. And I think that over the centuries, this imagination of witch's ointment was basically was not based on bioassay. It was based on a literary tradition and on. Because of political reasons. And the witch's hammer, that book to for the Inquisitors.
Malus Malficum.
That had been used in that time, like the drug laws used in this time.
It's true.
Yeah.
Persecution of consciousness.
And,
legislation of morality.
Yeah, and it was used to get off the pagan traditions.
Under pain of death.
Yeah.
Nightmares and non-killed.
Well, who knows?
People were tortured just to sign a confession.
Yeah.
Morbid fantasies.
Yeah, it's a whole fantasy thing. And the laws were made like you can use it this way or that way. It's like, what is it called in the American legislation, this analog?
Controlled Substance Analog Enforcement Act.
Yeah. So, you can put everything into it. In Germany, now the Green Party, that are real fascists, I tell you, I voted for them all the time, and now they turn out to be assholes.
Sounds familiar.
That doesn't happen in North America.
No, yeah.
They wanted to legalize cannabis, and now they even want to illegalize spores and spore prints of mushrooms.
Why?
Because they...
why are their minds closed like this?
Power. If you become a politician, you enter the game of power. And that was always the same, and they always used psychoactive substances to control. They do it all by themselves, and all the time it was like that. And all the so-called fathers or mothers of European civilization, they were all the freaks. They got killed by the government, like Socrates, and by the way, supposedly by hemlock, which was also seen as an ingredient in witches' ointments.
Galileo.
Hmm?
Galileo.
What?
Galileo.
Well, same I don't know.
Speaking of a leader of the edge like that.
We have to get into his files to see what drugs he took. Yeah, that's a very typical thing. So, before I close, I want to tell about a little bit of bioassay, what I really think, what the witches' plans are and the so-called witches' ointments. We produce several preparations and so, and we found out, after these recipes, and we found out we can put on like a lot of stuff on the body, it doesn't work. The only place where it works is the rectum and the vagina. And if you see the depiction of the witches, when they almost like they rubbing the clit on the groom.
They're invaginating.
My conclusion is of that, that it's an aphrodisiac, because that really enhances erotic feelings and desire, used for sex, especially for anal sex, because for that you need a salve. And that was, of course, the main thing that was totally illegal, legalized by the Catholic Church, because they only want you to produce...
What? To procreate.
To procreate, yeah. And sex for fun? No way. You're a witch. Immediately. And if you do what they in that time called sodomitic practices, that's anal sex, that was one of the main reasons to put people into jail and to burn them. Because that is sex for fun. And that is an old secret in magical practices, that the anal sex is totally connected with either mystical experiences or with some really deep experience. And totally connected with people having fun and insight. And for example, in Tantra, they do it to feed the Kundalini snake. So the man has to offer his semen into the rectum of the woman to give the power to the snake. And it works perfectly in this way. So now you can dream up your bioassays.
So it's really just a lubricant. An ancient KY gel or whatever.
Bioassay, Chris John.
What were the recipes?
It was based on henbane, putting in a little belladonna and a little bit of datura. And some essential oils and little opium and cannabis. And then if you have sex, you really get high with it. And I think that's the purpose of life, to have the most beautiful experiences you can have. I mean, many people don't think that like anal sex with drugs is really dirty or bad or so. But and I heard that in some states of the U.S. it's still illegal today. And sure. It's very strange. But everything that gives pleasure and may give you magical flights or shamanic experiences is illegal. If you look at the drug laws, every plant that was or still is sacred in shamanic cultures is illegal. So shamanism is illegal. And that was the same thing in the witch's time. Shamanism was illegal, but they called it witchcraft. And it's a kind of prohibition of...
Yes, witchcraft. It's the same thing. They want to make a neurotransmitter illegal. Prohibition of a state of consciousness.
Yeah, sure.
Same old crap.
Yeah, and that's you can find in all these literary sources from classical antiquity until today. We still have a state of where shamanism is illegal, and I collected some stuff on shamanism where they say, "Oh, yeah, it's in reality, it's witchcraft," and so on, and people. Still demonize shamanism, especially in the context of using entheogens, and that goes on and on. Even the Tibetan lamas prohibited shamanism. Maybe you have never heard of that, but they had a real
excuse me, somebody has a phone call from room
79.
Oh, 69.
69?
Who's in 69?
Oh.
Good number.
Yeah. It's in that context. You already got the illegal thing.
And,
where is it?
So, I want to close now, but one thing is very, very important to add. All these so-called witches' plants you find in the recipes, they always have been used as shamanic inebriants or entheogens, and had been used for divination, had been used in love potions, had been used as aphrodisiacs, and had been used to get high. And but also some of these plants had been used to kill people, like aconite is maybe one of the most deadly plants in Europe. And so it depends always on the dosage. If you use this or the other plant or this combination or that for medicinal or healing purposes or as an incense or as an aphrodisiac or as a shamanic entheogen, and or as a deadly poison. So the summary of this all is there always had been people who know the properties of the plants, and they could deal with them, and they could handle them in a beneficial way instead of a harmful way. And that is that brings me back to the metaphor with the knife. You can cook with it and keep life alive, or you can kill with it. And that is the essential meaning from the word pharmakon. And that is always the stuff the so-called witches used. I think I'm done.
Well, I hope all you psychedelic witches out there took some good notes, because the truth is, in times like these, we need as many of you as we can find. And most importantly, I hope that you'll go back and re-listen to Christian's warning in about the two-thirds of the way through the tape. You know, he wasn't joking about having a sitter tie you down if you were so foolish as to actually ingest something like henbane. And, you know, the same holds true, by the way, for all psychedelic medicines. As Christian says, almost every one of these has an upper dose limit where they become a poison, you know, and often a deadly poison. So let's be really honest, you know, here, being a psychonaut is really serious work, and not everybody should feel compelled to do it. You know, consciousness exploration can be done in many, many ways, and it's a calling. You know, it's not something you do because your friends are doing it. If you are called, well, then do it properly, you know. First, research things. You know, if you're looking for legal questions, go to cognitiveliberty.org. Or looking to see what's going on in psychedelic research, go to maps.org. But the first place you should always go if you're interested in any of these things is Arrowwid, E-R-O-W-I-D, arrowwid.org. It's the most comprehensive and reliable source of information about these medicines that you're going to find anywhere, online or offline. It should always be your first stop. And by the way, if you're trying something new, then you should read all of the bad trip reports first. And if you can't handle one of them, then move on, because we can all handle the good trips, right? And actually, step two is to be sure you know the rules. You know your body, know your mind, know your substance, and know your source. And step three, of course, always, as in always, have a sitter. But, hey, you know, I don't have to tell you this. You already know it. Just be smart. Be careful. You know, there's already been enough collateral damage in the war on drugs. Well, that's it for today. So thanks again to Chatul Hayuk for their music. And again, thank you, Mateo, for the tape recording. And thank all of you out there in cyberdelic space for joining us here in the Psychedelic Salon. For now, this is Lorenzo signing off from cyberdelic space. Be well, my friends. Thank you.